Welcome back. Now we're all hydrated and stuffed full of sugar and butter and lovely things. I know, I feel better. I realized in welcoming you back after hydrating ourselves that I forgot to talk about hydration with the dying. People stop taking in fluids and food, and most of us are incredible nurturers, and it's something we can do. We can encourage someone to eat, we can encourage them to drink. And the body, in fact, as it's shutting down, it loses its appetite and its thirst for a reason. It's because the body is shutting down, and those organs that process the fluids and foods are no longer functioning. And it is not appropriate for us to, after a certain point, offer food and fluids. So how do we tell what that point is? That is the million-dollar question. And what I have been telling families for a long time is, well, first of all, look at the person. And if they're saying they're not hungry and they don't want anything, that's a good clue. If they're not able to speak and you're offering something and they pull away, that's a really good clue. And so it becomes one of this, we have to let go of the need to provide. There's a really good body of research on hydrating the actively dying as actually being harmful and painful. And I like to tell the story of my neighbor who was a cat. Her cat was very ill. She took the cat to the vet. The vet said, here's some IV, not IV, you can do it subcutaneously, which means you just stick it under the skin. But here's some fluids, you can take the cat home, hydrate him, and he'll feel better. So she gets home and she thinks about it. And so she calls me and she says, I know you don't do cat hospice, but what do you think about this? And so I said, well, knowing what I know about hydrating and illness, if the body is at a point where it is ready to go, the hydrating will be painful. If the body is at a point where it needs it, it'll be a relief. And she says, okay, how do I tell? And I said, well, you can always start it and see how the cat reacts. She called me back a couple hours later and she said, oh my God. She had started the fluids. The cat started screaming as only a cat can. She took it off right away. I just love that story she gave me because it is so clear. It is so clear. And maybe human being bodies are a little more complicated and we react more slowly and not as dramatically. But that supports all the research that I've had thrown at me for years, is if the body is ready to go, don't feed it, don't water it, just support it in what it needs for comfort. I'm saying it, and that sounds really clinical.
The trouble is that for the previous decades of this person's life, love meant feeding and fluids, and so it's an art to help the family really understand what you're saying, because it's anti everything that has been before,
and it comes up.
So they think we're starting.
If I can't do that, what can I do? What can I do? If you get past the I'm going to starve them, and you're accepting the information, but then it's. But there's nothing left for me to do. What can I do to help this person? And those are all skills this room is full of people who have skills in that department, so we don't need to go into that. I just want to acknowledge that there is definitely a time to stop being that kind of nurturing. And
well, the nurturing changes.
That's right,
yeah,
move
to
another form of
nurturing. We continue
to
care, but that's not the
focal point.
Could you comment just on touch and massage? Or like, is that sometimes helpful at certain stages or not?
I would go by the person. Mm-hmm. You know, you have somebody there, it seems like, oh, a massage would be really nice, but if they start feeling like this, mm-hmm. it probably doesn't feel good. Sometimes the nerves get hypersensitive, mm-hmm. and it's just the right thing to calm them down, and sometimes it's just the wrong thing. So I really, again, I just keep saying, look at who it is, and look at the response. Don't try to go by a textbook. This is what I do at this time. Just be open to what is going on with this person, physically and spiritually. What is going on, and how can I meet that person there? Mm-hmm. Not bring my agenda, bring some of my knowledge, but not bring my agenda, just meet them there and see where we go together.
Maybe there's another weight. Why am I touching?
And why am I touching?
I think we do that for ourselves a lot too, because we need to touch rather than something they need.
That's a real, thank you. Oh, that's cool.
Sometimes the touching part keeps the person here. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the families don't want to stop touching. And sometimes the person almost seems like they're almost gone, and then somebody else will come in the room and then they're back, and that can go on for hours and hours. And sometimes it takes, coaching about, you know, this work of letting go. I mean, they probably don't really want to leave you any more than you want them to leave. It's hard. It's hard work. But if we hang on, it can get in the way of leaving. But then again, it's any, you know, if anyone's guessing.
There's a third T. Why am I thinking? That's usually my biggest problem. So,
like trying to figure out what you're supposed to be doing, like
thinking that there's something I could do that would solve this problem, mm-hmm. and there's nothing.
Mm-hmm. Fix your mood.
I really wanted you to share something of the work that you do, because mm-hmm. I'd like people in this room to know about that.
Well, I meet the people after the death has occurred. And so in my county, I'm a crisis care support officer, which means we are dispatched to any unexpected death, and that could be a suicide, which Whatcom County has the highest suicide rate in the state. Mm-hmm. That's nothing to brag about. Mm-hmm. And murders, stillbirths, fatalities on the road. And so we are dispatched, we are the guests of the law enforcement or the firemen, because they need to investigate what has happened. And oftentimes it turns out to be a crime scene, and they need all their attention, the professional expertise focused on the victim and what caused this death. Who takes care of the families? And so that's what I do, and others like me. And oftentimes there's a fatality on a road, we have to go and do the death notification to the family, and that is very difficult. And oftentimes the law enforcement or the fire department does not want to do it themselves, and so you learn to do that. And then I stay with this family until I can safely hand them off to someone else who's all parts of their brains are working, because you know when you die, when you see a death, or you go deliver this fallacious news, the whole higher level thinking quits. It just goes into it, so they revert to their basic animal instincts, and so they really need to be talked to very quietly and very slowly, because their absorption rate of what you're sharing is going to be very limited. And so you just try to keep it simple and think through. And had you discussed what your loved one might want in the case of death? Most of the time, no. And then you get into, is the medical examiner going to take jurisdiction over the body, which is a whole other area, a convoluted trail that you don't want to walk down, or does the family have a funeral facility that will come and take the body? So I was talking yesterday on the ferry to Ashley, and the idea that the body doesn't immediately need to be removed from the premises was brand new to me. I did not know that. So, but nonetheless, and so I go to funerals, a lot of funerals. You end up having calls with people. I've ended up going to homes of people. The victim is someone I know from my past life, and therefore you've got family ties. I went to a stillbirth in Sudden Valley last June, and somehow there's something about trauma bonding, and that mom that lost that little baby girl has just sort of accepted me as part of her family. And so she comes out and we walk around Green Acres and she just processes. And so that's kind of what we do. Most people don't have any faith tradition, but what I have found very, very curious is that when you give them the news, even if they have never considered faith, they'll say, oh God, isn't that funny? So, but it's, I was saying to Nancy, when we were eating too much shortbread out there, that's my part of it. What we always try to remember is that this is their story. This isn't our story. And so for me as a Christian, dying to self is my daily top of my list. Get me out of the way. Get me out of the picture entirely. Just let the will of God be done.
Thank you for that. Yeah. When we're doing what we do, a lot of times our own life story parallels another's life story. And what we hope to have happen in this next time, and actually the rest of the retreat, is to visit some of our own life story. It's been my observation in myself and in this work that to the extent that we attend to our own grief, to that extent can we be present to another. And sometimes when that grief is in your face and parallel, it can be paralyzing. That's the time to do what you need to do there, but also get the kind of help. I sit before you as a good example of a bad example, in that I get that that in order to do this work, I need to have an open heart, and I also get that in order to do this work, I need some kind of protection, and I don't know where that space is still. I just know that my body hurts. And I believe it has taken in a lot of pain, and learning to deal with that is part of all of our stories. Is how do we experience the losses, the grief, small and large in our lives, through our lives, and attend to them in such a way that when it comes our time to take our last breath, that we're ready. We don't have a lot of grief work to do then, because we've been attending. And I think that's one of the gifts of this circle and this weekend, that we can do whatever work is ours to do. So we're going to spend the rest of this chunk of time eliciting stories. And we'd invite, if anything that you saw from the movie just went, oh yeah, or anything that we've said, or questions, or what comes up, what has come up for you, we'd invite that.
I think that's a beautiful example, Cheryl, that you just gave. How do we, those of us that are called to this work in the different facets of it, the different ways of it. How do we care for each other as kind of ancient funerarians and people who, you know, lived and help others, you know, through this time of life? And I think that's a really worthy question, you know, so we're not too isolated in our work. And, you know, for someone like you that, you know, carries such a, you know, profound job of entering, you know, people's lives when they've experienced really traumatic death, you know, it's like if we really, how do we care for each other and hold each other?
I want to speak to my reaction to tear soup. And I'm a very image-oriented person, and so having a overflowing pot of soup of tears, I get that. I come from a background of family who would talk about things way after the fact. We always joked about, we'd get a phone call from mom from above saying, oh yeah, by the way, I died last week. I mean, that was how we kind of dealt with things. I mean, you didn't deal with feelings in the minute. You dealt down the road. And for some reason, I'm at a place in life where I can do the tear soup. I have opened wide open to making a tear soup, and it's incredibly, it's just incredible because there's this life of, I'll deal with it tomorrow, but things have just burst wide open. And just a real quick story about something my family, we are only siblings left, both parents are gone, and in January, we had lived when we were young for a few years in the Virgin Islands. And during that time, we had twin sisters born. One of them died after a week. The other lived to be 18 and died. The one who died after a week was never really acknowledged. It's like, well, she's gone, it's better. You know, she was really sickly, and it's just as well she's gone. That was it. We had no idea where she was. We did no service. We did nothing. And 50 years later, we go back to find her as a group of four.
Just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, just last January. And so we get to the islands. I'm the eldest, so I was sort of the keeper of a lot of the memories of this was where and this is how we get here and things like that. But we found the government office. We found the ledger with her burial in there, and it, when it's recorded, they record where in the graveyard, and so there's a magic person who knows how to interpret that. But it was island time, so we had to wait a couple days to connect with that person to find out where she might actually be, blah blah blah. Fast forward, one of my sisters had made a plaque for her out of soapstone and brought it with her. Mm-hmm. I brought a vial of my mother. Mm-hmm. And we found a guy to make a little cement thing to put the plaque in. And what this whole experience was for me was all of a sudden I was in touch with my mother's grief that she had this infant and it died. And it was somewhere. My father paid $3. It was in the ledger, and she was gone. And I was so glad I brought my mother with me. We put her inside the cement and underneath the plaque. But it was for someone, and I know there are many, many, many of us in the world who come from backgrounds like mine of, we'll deal with it tomorrow. To finally be able to have that kind of contact, that intimacy with my siblings, it was just beautiful. And then my brother, unbeknownst to me, puts it together in a book. And it arrived in the mail. about 2 weeks ago. And it's like, oh, I have it here if anyone wants to see it. But that kind of ceremony and honoring and processing ritual has come out of years of recognizing that we need to deal with our own grief. We need to find out how to do things, which is exactly what we're doing here. And let me tell you, it's just incredible. There just aren't adjectives. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I have the book, and that was my response to Tear Soup, and I think I'm probably still working on the soup and tasting it.
Yeah.
Well, I think through your story, I helped answer my own questions, that by sharing our stories is how we care for one another and help each other see examples of ways that we can support and create ritual for one another. And it's beautiful the way you honored your mother that way. So my story that I need some help with from this circle is having a loved one, a former partner of mine. When she died, she would not allow me to be present at her, at our home. And all the community of sisters that we had, you know, known for many years were around her, and I was not allowed to come and be at the end of life and with her, and I still carry that grief, you know, that deep sorrow to not, you know, say I love you and whatever level of forgiveness or understanding, acceptance, you know. And I sort of recognize my own, I guess, ego part that, you know, wanted to be there, but I also recognize my heart that wanted to be there too. Mm-hmm. So soon I will go down to gather my things, and what I see is creating some ceremony for myself there at the land and at the ocean, and asking a few friends to come and help me say goodbye and release this story. Mm-hmm. So there's those stories of how we don't get to be present. They talk about presence, you know, and how can my presence be felt and true when we cannot participate in the end of life and someone that we love. So I appreciate being able to say this out loud to the circle.
Thank you. One thing that brought up for me was just, and I'm sure I don't work in this area at all. So, but I'm sure you feel called at times to help families who seem to be in need of some sort of ritual.
Yes.
You know, and curious what you do in that case. And, you know, do you find yourself adapting and offering ideas of ritual at that time then? Because I think that's an important part for us, and I imagine particularly sudden deaths, families are completely unprepared to think in terms of ritual and how to
I thought it was a learned thing. I thought I would get ritual out of a book, but my experience is that ritual can, at least in my experience, be so organic that it sort of almost has a life of its own. When when I went to be with my dad after he died, I cut his hair. He had this big old comb over, and I wanted some of this. I mean, he had short hair, but this part was really long and fuzzy, and I'd been kind of getting it out of his face for the last couple of weeks, and so I cut his hair. And as I looked at him, there was a bunch of stuff that wasn't good. And I took a piece of paper and pencil, and I said, I forgive you for driving drunk. I forgive you. I mean, the stuff that I'd been carrying for my whole life, though, it just came out of me. Almost like, it was almost like vomit, only it was written vomit. And then the thank yous came. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I wasn't planning that. And then this was a kind of a fun thing. Dad never played with us. He didn't know how. And Martha gave me this cork book that would be a book that I could, you know, write in around my dad's death. And we took his thumbprints. I mean, she had the little thing, and we were just like putting them in the book. and I started laughing, and she was, get over here, take over the thumb. I needed that. I didn't know how much I needed that. That paper, we ended up, was like, this thing needs to be burned with him. I mean, I don't care if anybody read it or not, but I needed to say it, and we taped it on his belly, and just said, funeral director, burn the whole thing. You know, I mean, please take this with him. Recently, I was with a Vietnamese family who were Catholic, and doing that 14 prayer rosary. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's the Hail Mary and the Our Father, and then there's a
five.
Glory be.
Yeah, there's glory be, but then it happens 14 times, and somebody reads something, but all of it was in Vietnamese. That's why I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, because I don't know what I'm talking about. But I knew it was Catholic, and I asked somebody nearby. We were on the 11th one, so I waited till 14. We were finished, and I knew enough about the Hail Mary that it said something about, and be with us at the time of our death. And this family, 2 days before, was not gonna, we're not gonna stop. We're gonna just keep doing this stuff. And so the intensivist said, go in there and see what you can do. And I was waiting. I was waiting for information. I was waiting for discernment. I was waiting to know what it was to do. And who to engage. There was 25 people. He had 12 kids. They were all there with their... so it was a packed room. And what I did was I went to him. And I said, you've just been held in this beautiful prayer space. And part of the prayer is that Mary would be with you at the time of your death. And that time is now. The time is very soon. And really the only question is, do you want to die here, or do you want to go home? And I knew that he wanted to go home. So, and we'd already talked to hospice, but they wouldn't go there until just taking some of what they were already doing by way of ritual, giving it back to them, not because I'm Catholic or know even what I'm talking about, but it was their prayer. And so they decided home was where they wanted to go, and I looked at all of them and said, so you're ready for a hospice consult, and you know, he could probably be home tonight. We can do that, but I just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. And then I said, and I was so grateful. Again, you know, where does this stuff come from? What we do know. I said, is there a special song that you sing at this time? And three of the sisters went, yes. They couldn't decide on what song that was, but yes, there was a song. And then, I mean, they had been this sing-songy Vietnamese Our Father and the Hail Mary. And it was just, it was beautiful, and it gathered them. But this song cemented them. And the patient had a tear. All of them were in tears. But they came together in that song. I felt so privileged to be there. And then I said, can you tell me about your song? What did you sing about? And she said, we sang about peace. And they did what they needed to do. And so I think ritual can be really organic.
Just asking that question was such a key
What was interesting to me when my mom died a few years ago, and I went, and she died very suddenly at night and unexpectedly. So the next day when the siblings gathered at the funeral home, because immediately the body was hauled off into a funeral home, out of my control, certainly, and I gathered with my siblings and I said, I need to see my mother's body. And my siblings were said, well, no, that would cost extra. They would have to lay it out. And I said, I am going to see my mother's body. You know, I needed some closure. I needed some ritual. And they were, I had to fight them in the funeral home. And I said, I'm going to see my mother's body. Well, she's not prepared in that way. And I said, I don't care. She doesn't need to be prepared. So they finally, in the midst of my tears and passion, they agreed to lay her out with just a simple cloth without decorating her up, which I didn't want anyway, and laid her in a room, and I was able to go in with a friend, and I just howled and cried and sang all the songs I'd actually just written up here the day before she died. And I was able to have my time of saying goodbye. But the fact that there was so much resistance to something so simple from the funeral industry, from siblings who are much more in this culture used to just burn them, get them out of the way, you know, we'll have a memorial in 3 months. And, you know, Ashley knows about this very well. And how difficult it is to push against that, to be able to find the space to create some kind of closure or ritual, even just for ourselves. It's not easy, but it can be done.
I dealt with a family in October, and it ended up, the young man was somebody I had actually been his high school counselor, and he had a twin sister. And he had died by suicide in Marine Park, which is in Bellingham. And so the mother had this overwhelming need to go to the spot. She kept just feeling drawn and drawn and drawn. As though, and my point here is that people often need some tangible proof that this person has ceased to live. And if you only hear about it, and he's deformed or so transfigured by it, you can't, I mean, a suicide victim is not usually something you want to see. And nobody allowed her the funeral. Actually, the coroner took, Gary Goldvogel took jurisdiction, which means game over. And he will not let families touch or have that time. But the funeral facility to whom the body is turned over sometimes may allow it if there's even a recognizable face. But families, I've just seen over and over how people, I don't believe you, I don't believe you, I can't believe you, I need to touch. And I think we have the right.
We do. We have the legal right, and we have the legal right to take the body home no matter what condition the body is in.
Oh,
just so you know.
Across the United States.
Across the United States, in your car.
You need to go
in your car.
I don't need to meet him. I know what the laws
that is great.
Say.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
But we have to advocate for what we want.
Unfortunately, the funeral industry is an industry.
Yeah.
And an industry is an animal into itself that wants to protect itself. So we become having to push as advocates. But unfortunately, that's where we are. But that's shifting. That's really shifting, and it doesn't take as much of a push. You just say, no, actually, the law allows me to take the body home now. I'll be taking the body home now. And you pull up in your car and you take him home. And it doesn't matter what condition they're in. People can be cleaned up. You'd be surprised with a little soap and water we do.
I need to say one thing. We're almost out of time. I think we end at 9:45, if I'm correct.
Ten till.
Okay, I'll say it real quick. Which is just if anyone wants to have a table discussion at lunch, I want to get it on the announcement sheet, and we have several likely subjects here already. So would someone like that, and what should be announced for today? We could have a different one at supper, we could have a different one tomorrow. But if we want it done, I need to
be ready to announce it. Any thoughts?
Difficult to hear, but
really hard to hear.
Really hard to hear in that. But further on the west end, you know about this, but the west end is a little quieter away from the games.
Mm-hmm. Although some of the people are going to be in silence.
So what would be a theme that's coming out of today that might be a carryover to a lunch discussion? Silence.
I think we're talking about our experiences of grief and how we deal. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Self-care as folks, as people, as hearts that go to the bedside, how we can take care of ourselves.
That's a great topic.
I couldn't hear it.
Self-care. How can we take care of ourselves as we're caring for others?
Yeah, self-care. It's a great topic.
I'm also part of the International Critical Incident Stress Management Team, so we get deployed to the big things like OSA or Katrina. And what we do there is we debrief the first responders, and we often do that with our law enforcement people, but then it dawns on me and two others. We've been around the block several times with this. We've taken to calling each support officer after a call and giving them the opportunity one to debrief, and I think it's really valuable because I know from my past career, we deal with so many confidential situations, and we truly need a safe person just to talk it through with, or else we're facing compassion fatigue and burnout.
That's right.
One more resource. This is called Friends in Need. This is a friend of mine from Bellingham who just published this, 101 Ways to Help a Friend in Need. Christine Magnuson, some of you know her. She's a therapeutic musician. But anyway, this is just came into the bookstore, which is open until 12:15. Okay, I'll get out of your way when it closes.
We'll take a couple more stories, but we hope that what's happened here is helping all of us recognize that all of us have tear soup on board. All of us have grief, have a story. All of us have a story. And our society doesn't do a very good job of seeing and hearing each other. But in this place, we can see and hear. So on behalf of the leadership team or whoever, if you want to talk, maybe not in a big group, but just need to say it. I'll never forget last year, a lady at the very end of the retreat, 70-something-year-old lady, came up to me and said, I've never told anyone that I had a stillbirth. I had a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And I never said it to anyone. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. in the saying of it, I watched the healing mm-hmm. begin. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. So we want that. But we also have a couple of minutes.
I have a nice story about the whole idea of ritual being organic and coming to you in a form that just naturally falls together. And my father died in 1979, and I was with him at that death. But my stepmother, once away, the body was whisked away, and he was cremated, and she kept these ashes and moved away and was gone. And I thought I was never, my dad wanted to be put into the Straits of Juan de Fuca. And I got a call this summer from a friend who said, there's a lady who's called me that wants to get a hold of you. She has something for you. She found your name on the internet. Who is this? And I called this person up. Her name was Nancy. And it turned out to be my stepmother's sister. And my stepmother had been moved into a home for dementia. And her sister had the urn my father had spent 35 years in, and she wanted to return it to me because she knew she could come back to me. So I just went, my God, 35 years in an urn. It's about time they let that man out. But it was kind of poetic justice. My father was a very charismatic, intelligent, wonderful alcoholic, womanizer, gambler. So, but I loved him nonetheless. And we met an anachordist. She gave me this
beautiful urn, and I took it home, and some friends said, oh, well, we'll take you out in our boat, you know, and you can put him into this great Zamana Fugo. Well, that kept not happening. And then I talked to my son, who lives in Colorado, who has a son who lives in Mexico that was visiting him and staying with him, and they were coming up for Thanksgiving, and they were coming. I said, you're coming to Victoria, and this is before it all kind of came together in my mind that, oh my God, the only descendants of my father from Mexico, to me, to my son, are all gathered in the place where my parents were married, where I was born. He's going in the drink right here. And so we had this little parade through Beacon Hill Park, where I grew up and played my whole life, you know, my dad, you know, and my mom, out to Finlayson Point, and together, Tober said, I need to get closer to the edge, and he's rolling up his pants, and the waves are coming in. And I have a picture I'll send around for you to see of my little grandson holding on to him so he doesn't fall in the drink along with the ashes. But we poured those ashes into the Straits of Georgia, the Straits of Juan Fuga, not the Straits of Georgia, but they're all connected. It's water. Off he went. And I said, in that moment, just spontaneously came up, a blessing for all people that have suffered from alcoholism and all people who have loved someone who has suffered from alcoholism. And then I just felt this joy. It was like I had done, the universe had given me every piece of this puzzle that I needed to go full circle with my dad and to have that completion. And, you know, I mean, phone call from here, this, that, you know, people from Mexico. It was just, it was magical. And I could not have, you know, done that on my own. I'll send this little picture around while somebody else is sharing their story. You can see my little Mexican grandson, Ramses, with his father, Tober, my son. And oh, the prologue to this is we're all, you know, Tober's getting his socks back on and we're getting ready to leave. And up pops a snorkeler. I thought, oh my God. And scoots herself up. It's a woman in this rubber suit. She was like beautiful with a spear gun. And I went, my brother always did like him. So it was like, and he got the escort that he needed. What she did to him, but off he went. Yeah, a hunter-gatherer.
What a great way to end the session with a story.
The story kitchen. Thank you for
so
sharing.
So, lunchtime, should we have a tabletop around caring for the caregivers? Is that what I was hearing?
That's
some people would be interested. How many? Could you raise your hand if that's
table
you would like to go to?
Is it safe to leave our belongings in here? It should be fine.
Okay. So
then
we have a song. Do we have a song?
We must have a song.
Song.
We must have a song.
That into the hotel.
Oh, there. Oh, yeah. No, it'll be the far end.
Far end, that end.
Yeah.
Okay, a song.
We could do Linda's "Like a Warm Breeze" again. That was so nice.
Okay. Go for it, Linda.
Like a warm